Welcome to the Rise Podcast. I'm Rachel Hollis, and I've built a multi-million dollar media company with a high school diploma and a Google search bar. Each week, we'll be sharing tangible, direct advice or inspiring interviews with the same intention. These are the tools to change your life. Today on the Rise Podcast, I'm joined by the founder of Charity Water, Scott Harrison. Scott has built one of the most admired nonprofits in the world, and he started out as a club promoter, drinking every day, doing drugs, smoking three packs every single day of his life. If you ever wanted to hear a story about redemption, about the ability to change who you are and become something new and beautiful, this is the episode for you. Hey, Scott, thank you so much for joining us on the Rise Podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's fun to chat.
Yeah. So I've already told Scott, I will tell you listeners, I am losing my voice. I know I sound a little crazy right now. So Scott is going to be a champion and totally carry this for us, which is awesome because your story is so compelling and interesting. If there are listeners who are not familiar with you, will you tell us who you are and a little bit about how you got to the place you're at now?
Sure. So I'm recording this from New York City. I live with my wife and two kids. I have a two-year-old and a four-year-old, older boy, younger girl. I get to walk about 7 minutes every morning from our apartment to the office, which helps because I'm on the road a lot, and lead an organization called Charity Water. And for 12 years, we have been fighting to make sure every single person on earth has clean water to drink. And currently, there are about 660 million people that don't. So one out of every 10 people alive is drinking dirty water right now as we talk. And we want that number to be zero. I guess I got into this through a pretty not traditional path. I was actually a nightclub promoter in New York City for 10 years. And going back even farther, there are three acts of my life. The first act was growing up in a very conservative Christian family, born in Philadelphia, raised in New Jersey. And when I was 4 years old, there was a terrible freak accident. There was a carbon monoxide gas leak in the home that we had just moved into. And it made my dad and I a little sick, and it completely destroyed my mom. On New Year's Day, 1980, she walked across the bedroom and she crumpled to the floor unconscious. And the blood tests revealed this massive exposure to carbon monoxide that had just happened over time as we were breathing in these invisible fumes in this new house. And that was really a moment where everything changed in my life. And mom went from a healthy, vibrant wife and mother to an invalid wearing weird charcoal masks connected to oxygen tanks, living in containment rooms that were covered in aluminum foil, and her clothes were being washed in baking soda 20 times. So just a really weird compromised immune system as a result of this. And the Scott as a kid was just the good Christian kid who played by all the rules. I played piano every Sunday in church in the worship band, and I didn't smoke. I didn't sleep around. I didn't drink. I didn't cuss. I did all the right things. And then 18 happened.
Yeah.
And then act two of life happened. And it sounds so cliche now, but I literally lived out the prodigal son experience. I flipped the bird to my parents. I flipped the bird to the church. And like, now it's my turn. Okay, played by the rules, did that thing. Now I'm going to try the other sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. And I moved to New York City. I actually did join a band, so I was playing rock and roll. Joined a band, grew my hair down to my shoulders, start smoking, drinking, sleeping around, gambling, drugs. And the band breaks up pretty quickly because we just despised each other and we're all doing drugs. And that's, yet another cliche of, the grunge band that breaks up. Oh my gosh, imagine that. But I had already moved to New York City at this point, and I came across this profession in New York at 19 years old, where I realized you could get paid to professionally drink. So there was actually a job in New York City where you could drink for a living and make hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was called a nightclub promoter. And all you had to do was get, you know, beautiful people and then some rich people inside the right clubs at the right times. And you could charge them, you could tax them astronomically for alcohol. I mean, people would actually pay $20 for a vodka soda that makes, that costs 20 cents to make, or they'd pay $1,000 for a bottle of champagne that cost, you know, 50. So I determined that I am going to, in my act of rebellion, I'm going to rebel in style, and I'm going to become New York City's king of nightlife. I'm going to, you know, sit at the top of all nightlife. And I pursued that for about 10 years, and I worked at 40 different nightclubs. And, you know, I got pretty close to the top. There were probably eight of us that were running, you know, nightlife in the city at that time. And I, you know, on the outside, my life looked great. I looked successful. I was dating girls that were on the cover of fashion magazines. I drove a BMW. I had a Rolex watch. I had a Labrador Retriever. I had a grand piano in my New York apartment. Like all these things that I'd collected that felt like the markers of success. But on the inside, I was rotting. It was so dark and depraved and degenerate. And, you know, I'm a massive user of cocaine, ecstasy, MDMA, Ambien. I have a gambling problem. I have a pornography and strip club addiction. I've smoked 2 to 3 packs for 10 years, so I have a coughing problem. Pretty much any vice that you might imagine would come with a life in nightlife, I've assumed I've taken on at this point. And I come to this realization on a vacation in South America at 28 years old, almost 10 years in the business, that I have slowly, but then suddenly, you know, it seems, become the worst person that I know. Mm. I mean, there is no one more emotionally decrepit and bankrupt. There's no one more spiritually bankrupt than I am. And I've betrayed every single foundational virtuous thing that I was brought up to believe in. And as I just thought about legacy, as I played my life forward, I mean, I wasn't even sure I would live to be 40 if I kept this up. You know, I might just die of a drug overdose. But if I actually did continue down this path, my legacy, I might perhaps leave one of the most meaningless legacies of any person on earth. I mean, my tombstone could read, "Here lies a guy who's gotten 1 million people wasted."
Yeah.
You know, I mean, who wants that on their tombstone? I mean,
and is there a certain amount of shame in that realization? Like, does that, I feel like that's such a massive place of understanding to get to, like, okay, I've hit the bottom, but what is the emotion that comes with it? Because most often, whatever you're feeling after that realization actually feels like another weight on your chest instead of something that's going to propel you.
Shame, such an interesting word. My parents used to have this expression over the years that said, you know, my conscience was being seared. And I used to hate this, like the churchy language, right? I'm like, my conscience is not a piece of tuna. You know, I'm not throwing it on a skillet, okay? But in some ways, that actually happened. I mean, the voice that said, hey, this stuff is wrong, just got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, it's like that little voice was in the corner of the room and I threw, you know, a sofa on top of it and just, I didn't hear it anymore. I think it was less shame, and I think it was more of a longing to come home. You know, it was this, wow, things were better back then, and left to my own devices. You know, I didn't do this well. I mean, it's almost that, you know, how you imagine the in that parable in the Bible of the prodigal son. Like, he's like, my servant, you know, the servants at my dad's house, like, are living better than the mess I've made of my own life. And I want to come home. I miss that. So I think I missed the spirituality. I missed faith. I missed virtuous living. As a kid, I used to help take care of my mom. I wanted to be a doctor so I could help other people. And I'd gone so far from all that. So I have this realization, and I come back to New York City, and I just try to fix the problems. Because I'm still partying for a living. I mean, that was my job, and I needed to do that to support my lifestyle. But I try to smoke less and sleep around less and do less drugs. And I was just kind of flailing and failing at all that. And, you know, I write about this a lot more in depth in the book. But there was a moment in nightlife that caused me to leave the city for a couple of weeks and get some even more perspective. And you know, I remember just taking a break from nightlife. I rent a car from the Newark airport on a one month rental. I have no idea where I'm going. And I just start heading north with a bottle of Dewars and a carton of Marlboro Reds and a Bible. And I wind up in Moosehead Lake in Maine at this dial-up internet cafe with a bunch of like old Dell computers. And I asked myself, what would the opposite of my life look like? Not a 10 degree shift or a 25 degree shift or, you know, not a pivot. What would the extreme 180 degree opposite picture of Scott's life look like? And I thought, well, it would look like I quit all this stuff, all this crap that I'm doing, and I would go serve others for 1 year, almost as a tithe or a penance for the 10 years that I'd selfishly wasted. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to apply to a humanitarian organization. I want to volunteer. I want to go to a poor country and see if I have anything to offer. And I'll never forget, from this dial-up internet cafe, I just start filling out these long applications to the humanitarian organizations I've heard of over the years, the Save the Children's and World Visions and Samaritan's Purse and UNICEF and the Peace Corps. And I never go back to my life in New York City. I liquidate almost every material possession that I have, down to my DVD collection. I remember putting up 2,000 DVDs that I owned just in a single lot, trying to just purge, trying to start over. And to my dismay, over the next couple of weeks, I'm denied by all the organizations that I apply to.
Oh my gosh.
Right? Which kind of makes sense, right? People listening are like, well, no, yeah, of course he did. Like, he's a drunk, drug addict nightclub promoter. Like, these are serious organizations and serious people. But I had actually gotten a degree at NYU in journalism, and I'd been a pretty good writer and a pretty good photographer. And one of these organizations, the one that hadn't yet denied me, actually, I later found out, Rachel, they had denied me, and then they had to go through the rejected applications because they couldn't fill the position. So they call me up and they say, we have this mission. It's a medical mission on a humanitarian ship, and we're going to sail to Liberia, the poorest country in the world. And if you are willing to pay us $500 a month, and you go live in this country, then we'll meet you. We'll meet you and consider you.
A volunteer.
Isn't it brilliant?
That is insane. Okay.
Isn't it brilliant?
Yeah.
So this is really the opposite of my life. Not only am I going to the actual single poorest country in the world at that time, Liberia had just come out of a 14-year civil war led by Charles Taylor and his child soldiers. And this was a country with no electricity, no running water, no sewage system, no mail system, and one doctor for every 50,000 citizens.
Oh my gosh.
In America, we have a doctor for every 300 of us.
Wow.
Just for comparison. So not only am I going to the poorest country in the world, I have to pay to do it. This is perfect. Like, I'm going to go broke doing it. So I'm like, yes, I'm in. Here are my credit card details. And it happens so quickly. A couple weeks later, I am on a huge 522-foot hospital ship with 350 other doctors and surgeons and volunteer medical crew and support staff sailing into West Africa to see how many people we're going to be able to offer free medical services to. And everything changed for me the minute I set foot in Africa.
Oh my gosh. So I mean, like, I have 900 questions based on just that story. But what I love and what I think is a really great piece of knowledge here is, like, I read something recently that said the price of your new life is your old one. And I feel like that.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, right? Like, you wanted to make change, and you didn't just want to make a little change. You wanted to make drastic change. And that means that you needed to do something totally drastic. When you decided to do that, how, like, the community that you had built around you, what was their reaction to, oh, by the way, I'm going to go to a ship and we're going to go to Liberia? Like, what, did you have support from people, or were people like, you're crazy?
There was a lot of curiosity, but what I think surprised me, there were some people that thought I was doing this just to get girls, you know? Oh, come on, Scott's a humanitarian now?
Oh,
like,
gosh.
I just did blow with this guy,
yeah,
like, at 4 a.m. in some shady after hours, and, like, now he's off saving the world? Please, right? There was definitely a fringe element of pure cynicism, but I was surprised because I wrote a really heartfelt email about what I was hoping to achieve and how I wanted to change my life and turn it around. And most people sounded jealous. Rachel, like, wow, I wish I could go do that. I wish I could be with a group of doctors who are giving up their time as volunteers to, you know, on a hospital ship sailing into a country that needs help. Like, tell me how it goes. Like, tell me how I can join. Tell me how I can give money. So I was really surprised. And that was the beauty. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to write Thirst, the reasons I wanted to kind of get my story down is I really believe that no one is past, no one is unredeemable. Mm-hmm. And I have picture after picture of all of these things in my life that have been redeemed almost in a moment. And then, you know, so for example, I rolled into Africa with 15,000 influential people on my nightclub list. Same people that I've been getting wasted for 10 years. Like Mick Jagger was on our email list, mm-hmm. you know? And back then email open rates were like 100%.
Yeah. Totally.
So everybody got it. So, you know, they went from getting invitations to the Prada megastore opening in Soho or MTV's party or Cosmopolitan magazine's party. They went to getting images of people with leprosy. People with cleft lips and cleft palates, children with giant facial tumors suffocating them, kids drinking dirty water. So I was able in a moment to kind of redeem the people, you know, the tribe that I had collected over 10 years and tell them a completely new story, a redemptive, important story about compassion and sacrifice and giving. And to my surprise, most of them were really receptive.
You guys, after months of waiting and a year of writing, my new book, Girl Wash Your Face, is finally out in the world. I want to thank you so much, every single one of you who has bought the book on ebook or a physical copy or on audio. Your support means the world to me. And if you are listening to my podcast and you haven't yet bought the book, you're dead to me. No, I'm totally kidding, but I am serious about how important this book is. I keep talking about it because I sincerely believe there are tools in it that can help change your life. So if you have the $16, I want you to go buy it right now because you love your pal Rach. And if you don't, head to the library or borrow it from a friend. But if you care enough to listen here, you're gonna love the wisdom inside of this book. Girl, wash your face. I promise you will not be sorry you did. I love that too. It's such a great example of the idea that when we change ourselves, when we change ourselves for the better, we inevitably start, like, the ripple effects of that start to change our community and the people around us. And even those first people who saw the email who thought, man, I'd love to, what if I, you know, what does my thing look like? What if I changed my life? What if I did something different? I think the piece that you didn't mention that I'd love to bring up because I think it's really relevant is you were having some pretty bad health problems too, with the numbness in your, will you talk about that? Because I'm also someone who has worked themselves until they got physically ill and nobody, it was like the medical mystery nobody could solve. So that really resonated with me.
Yeah. So right before I went on this trip to South America, half my body just goes numb.
It's so crazy.
And I start going to neurosurgeons and getting MRIs and, you know, connecting sensors to my arms and legs. And no one can figure out what's wrong. You know, my club partner's like, dude, why don't you lay off the coke, you know, and knock three packs a day of cigarettes down to like 1.5, right? And you know, so that just started happening. And I remember, you know, I would run my hand under burning hot water and I couldn't feel it. You know, I could scald my hand without any sensation.
Wow.
It's like I could have just smashed a hammer and just, it was numb. It was bizarre. And I remember so vividly, it was in the middle of the night and I woke up and I walked over to my computer and I started just trying to self-diagnose. And I typed into, I think it was Google at the time, you know, numbness. And I, instead of getting a medical explanation, I got like some sermon about how, you know, you could be completely spiritually dead. And, you know, I remember that was like a soul wake up call for me. I almost felt like I felt mortal for the first time. I mean, I'd been living like I was going to live forever, you know, running around recklessly. And, you know, I began to ask some tough questions. Do I still believe in heaven and hell? Like, you know, because I know which door I'd be knocking on, yeah. right? If it was all still true. And so that kind of led to, you know, the reawakening of faith and spirituality and morality. And I will say that before I walked up the gangway of that hospital ship, before I surrendered my passport and kind of became one of the crew, I quit it all. And I went out with a bang. I smoked, you know, packs of cigarette the night before. I had 8 beers. It was funny doing interviews for the book. People, the volunteers remember me turning up reeking of alcohol. Wow. Like I just come from a bar. But that was it. I never smoked again. I never touched coke again. I never gambled again. I never looked at a pornographic image again. I quit everything. I mean, I drink wine and beer now, but I just walked away from all those vices. And I believed that it had to be this radical almost act of obedience to step into a new life, you know, to turn the page and to start over with a clean slate. And there was something almost prophetic or symbolic about walking up the gangway of a ship and imagining the gangway, you know, being retracted and then sailing off to a new continent, to a new life, and leaving all of that crap, all that detritus behind.
Wow. So you get to Liberia and you're using these connections that you've made to help the cause along. Tell me how you get from that place to one of the most notable charities that exists in the world today.
Well, you know, I was with doctors and surgeons who were maxillofacial surgeons. And the first year was really spent documenting these unbelievable before and after photos. And by unbelievable, I mean, you know, imagine a 14-year-old child living in a country with no access to medical care, with no surgeon in a broken country and no place to operate. Actually, there were 2 surgeons in a country of millions, but they had no place to operate. So effectively, there were no surgeons. So imagine, you know, a 14-year-old child suffocating to death with a 4-pound tumor that has filled his entire mouth and pushed out his teeth.
Wow.
And you know, terrified that he's choking to death effectively on his face. And then these amazing surgeons come in and they remove the tumor and they sew him back up and they give him a new jaw and a titanium plate and he's restored back to health. So I'm taking these photos of kind of extreme, radical, horrific suffering and then the joy that comes with the joy and the hope that comes with these healings. So that's kind of the first year and I'm blasting my club list. And of course there's some unsubscribes. People are like, this is gross. Like leprosy, don't send me that. I want to go hang out at the Chanel party. But most people, I would say 99% are like, this is amazing. How do I give money to pay for a surgery like that? Or how would I join you on the ship? So the first year goes by and then the second year I get off the ship and I spend more and more time in the rural areas, out in the villages, out in the bush. And I see the water that people are drinking, Rachel. And it's disgusting. People are drinking from brown, viscous swamps, from ponds, from dirty rivers that look like they're flowing with chocolate milk. You know, kids are wading through algae, fecally contaminated water, you know, where dogs and cows have pooped in it. And they're drinking this water. And I learned that half of the sickness throughout the developing world, what some people might call the third world, half of the sickness is actually caused by dirty water and a lack of sanitation and hygiene. And I learned that half the country, 50% of the people in Liberia are drinking dirty contaminated water. So I just put this, you know, these very basic things together. People are really sick in this country to such extent that our doctors were turning away thousands of patients. People would come. So many people would come for help that we just didn't have enough doctors. We didn't have enough operating theaters. We didn't have enough beds on the ship's hospital. So we would turn away thousands of people, many of them who had walked for a month, that actually walked from a neighboring country, often with their children, in the hopes of seeing a doctor that could save their child's life. And we're saying, we don't have enough doctors. Sorry, come back next year if the kid's still alive.
Wow.
So I'm just putting these two things together. Well, maybe the root cause of so much of the sickness that we're seeing is actually the disgusting water that people are forced to drink because there is no clean water in these villages. And I think it was especially a contrast for me because in my club life, I was selling bottled water for $10 a bottle.
Wow.
Like, it's vast. You want sparkling or still,
yeah.
Right? And people would buy five or 10 bottles in the club. They wouldn't even open the water. They would just let it sit there because they were drinking champagne or vodka instead. So I just couldn't believe that, you know, not only half this country we were living in was drinking bad water. I then learned at the time it was 1 billion people worldwide. 1 billion people, one out of every six people alive on the planet was drinking bad water. And this just became the problem that I wanted to solve. You know, I'd seen a lot of things, but this was not okay on my watch. Not if I could do something about it.
What I love too, and I just want to point this out for, because we do have a lot of listeners who have dreams of working with nonprofits or building their own. And I think that the really important note here is that you were not treating the symptom. It wasn't, I mean, you were in a space where you were doing this medical care, but you went back to the cause. And so often I think in the nonprofit space and in the charity space, we are trying to treat the thing that happens instead of backing up and figuring out what causes it in the first place. So I just love, and it's one of the reasons I love what y'all do, is that you're not just doing the medical work after the fact. You're actually trying to get it before it causes health problems.
Mm. Yeah. So that was how I found my way to water. And now I had my mission. But then I needed to figure out how to actually make an impact. And the problem was, so I'm 30. I'd just done 2 years, 28 to 30 with the Mercy Ships. Now I'm living clean. So I come back to New York City, unrecognizable to so many of my friends because I'm not partying with them. But I'm also broke. And I find out that my business partner in the clubs never paid our taxes, nor did he dissolve our small S corp. So I also find that I'm $30,000 in debt. And well, I'm sorry. Sorry, bro. All the unopened mail is in the bathroom. So like, you want to go deal with that? Like, more power to you, right? He said, but you can crash in my apartment. So I was crashing in a spare room and then the closet floor. I'm actually living on a closet floor in a loft in New York City, $30,000 in tax debt. And I just decided I'm gonna start this thing in faith. And yeah, I got in a payment plan immediately with the IRS and file those back taxes. But I'm running around telling everybody, I'm showing them some of the photos that I had taken over the last couple of years with this laptop, just saying, I wanna help everybody on earth get clean water to drink. Because of the privilege that I was born into a middle-class family, you know, in Philadelphia, I never had to drink dirty water. I'm the five out of six, but I want to help the one out of six. And what I learned, you know, I guess what, as a budding entrepreneur in this moment, was that this wasn't going to be easy because people didn't trust charities. And as I talked to everyday people, right, these were not institutional philanthropists. I talked to just the public. People are like, man, I don't give to charities. I don't trust charities. They waste money. You know, charities are black holes. You never know how much actually gets to the people in the end. And, you know, all these charity CEOs, they pay themselves millions and millions of dollars. And some of them hire their cousins and their family members. And, you know, everybody seemed to have a scandal, a story they could pull out of their back pocket and say, this is why we don't trust. This is why we don't give. And I learned there was real data behind this. USA Today, I think it was, had polled Americans and found 42% of Americans said that they actually don't trust charities. And NYU had done another study that found 70% of Americans thought charities wasted money, or get this, or badly wasted money. So this shocks people, right? Because no one's more generous than Americans, right? We have this cultural heritage of philanthropic support and generosity. But 70% of the people in the country that were polled said charities wasted money. Well, that's what charities are in the business of doing, is turning money into impact. So I thought, okay, the system, I can't just jump into the traditional system, which seems broken. But I wonder if I could start with a clean piece of paper and do something very different, do something very new. How would I win the cynical back? How would I win the 70% and say, hey, we've got a different business model here. Come back to the table. Give it a try. Take another look. And in some ways, you know, I was, and maybe this will help people. On paper, I was uniquely unqualified to do any of this. I would be the last person that you would expect 12 years later would have raised a third of $1 billion, you know, for charity and helped 8.5 million people get clean water around the world. Okay. I was living on a closet floor, $30,000 in debt with no charitable experience at all, but just, there was like this holy discontent. Like I felt like there was a responsibility to do something about what I'd seen and to make an impact in this issue. So having the clean slate, I'm like, okay, well, it seems like the biggest problem people have is with money. So what if we just promised that 100% of every donation we ever took would always go to help people get clean water, would go to build projects to get people clean water. And people are like, well, that's the stupidest thing we've ever heard. How would you actually pay yourself someday or your staff someday or an office? And I'm like, I don't know, but I'm going to open up 2 bank accounts and we'll figure that out separately. So that every donation, whether somebody gives $1 or $100 or $1 million, it all goes straight. So you can't use the excuse with us how much of my money will go, because the answer will always be 100%. That was pillar number one. Pillar number two was, okay, well, if we've actually separated out the overhead, then money is no longer fungible. It doesn't just go into one big pot. So we can actually use technology to track what we're doing with these dollars. We can show people where the money goes. And we started by just putting every water point up on Google Earth and Google Maps. So we could show people the satellite images of the actual water projects as they were built. So proof became this pillar. And then the third thing was, I just wanted to build an amazing looking and feeling brand. As I looked at the charitable sector, I saw anemic brands, I saw lame websites, I saw bad email marketing, I saw the shame and guilt left over. You might remember those commercials with the flies, right? Landing on the African kids as they looked up with sad eyes and slow motion, and the 800 number comes, right? It's not how you build a brand. First of all, you don't watch that commercial and go tell your friends about it, but you certainly don't wear the t-shirt of the charity. It's almost as if, you know, Nike were to market, you know, their brand by telling Americans how fat and lazy they were. And oh, by the way, you're pretty stupid. Why don't you turn off the TV and go for a run, right? And please buy our clothes while you go jog. Right? People don't want to be talked to like that. And that's not what Nike's done. They've said there's greatness inside you. You can run farther and faster than you ever thought possible if you just give it a try. And they tell stories of people overcoming adversity and climbing mountains, you know, who've lost legs or playing basketball if you've lost arms. And something is like, I want to tell my friends about that. I want to wear that logo. You know, I want to align with a company who might believe that there's something greater inside me. So I had that vision from day one of kind of winsomely calling people to radical compassion and to generosity and saying, you care more than you think you do. You have a higher capacity to care. You have a higher capacity to help your neighbor in need, to give generously. And this should be fun. You know, in fundraising, what are the first three letters? It's not down-raising. It's not shame-raising. It's not guilt-raising. It's fundraising. You know, it should be a joy. It should be a blessing. You know, I hate the language that's so common in our culture now around giving back. You know, this makes it sound like we have pillaged and plundered to such extent that, oh, we finally should probably throw a few scraps back to the poor, right? Let's give a little back.
That's so good. I haven't thought about that before, but you're so right.
Drop back. Just drop back. Let's talk about giving. Frame it in the positive. Our company, our family, our faith community has a culture of giving. Giving because we can, giving out of because we've been blessed, giving our time and our talent and our money because it's a joy, not out of debt or obligation. So just, you know, kind of put all these things. And then the fourth pillar was not to send anyone that looks like a, you know, white male to Africa or India or Southeast Asia to go drill a well. I just believe that for the work to be culturally relevant and sustainable, it must be led by the locals in each of these countries where we'd work. So our role could be getting people with resources to care about their neighbors suffering around the world without clean water, to raise money as efficiently and transparently as possible. But then the actual work that would be carried out by Ethiopians in Ethiopia. Right.
Yes. And can we dig into that for just one quick second? Because there are so many people listening who don't have your experience with nonprofits and this work in other countries. Can you explain why it's important that if you are giving money, if you are supporting charities, that you will look for people who are doing work with local community leaders, not us going to another country and telling them what we think they need.
I think you just said it, right? No one listening to that disagrees with that. I think, you can make a mess of things if you come in with your own set of ideas. There was a book once called White Man's Burden that a professor out of NYU wrote, a guy called Bill Easterly. And he talks about the planners and the searchers. And the planners are like, okay, we got this all figured out, right? We're just going to come and drop our 10-point plan of economic development on you. And he gives an example of a charity that that bought like, I don't know, 100,000 solar ovens or something, right? Because they're like, mm-hmm. Hey, you shouldn't be using fuel. It's expensive. It's dirty. It's causing upper respiratory, you know, using charcoal and burning down trees is not good for the environment. It's not good for your lungs. So we're going to give you solar ovens. Well, nobody used them. Because it gets cold at night and people keep themselves warm by the fire. And the fire is a social, it's like the social fabric of the community. And that's where the stories were told. So, you know, had they actually gone in searching, right, and gone in humbly asking, you know, maybe they would have piloted 100 of them, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, look, I think the locals probably would have told them, hey, nobody's going to use a solar oven around here. Okay. This just isn't a good idea. And in other contexts, it's a great solution, right? Or maybe with the right training or the right discussion or the community involvement, it could have worked. So yeah. So that was the last pillar. So give away 100%, prove to people what we've done with their money, build an epic, imaginative, inspiring, hopeful brand, and then work with local partners. And day one to get this thing started, I just threw a party in a nightclub. It was the only good idea I had at the time. It was my 31st birthday.
Do what you know. I love it.
But even that felt kind of redemptive because, you know, I got the club donated and I got the booze donated and we gave everybody open bar for an hour. And as they came into the club, I said, please put $20 in this plexi box and we're going to take 100% of whatever's in this at the end of the night to a refugee camp in northern Uganda, and we're going to build our first projects. And I'll never forget, Rachel, that night, a marijuana dealer walked in, and he put $500 in that box. And he said, this is the first charitable gift I've ever made in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, we're on to something, right? Because there's no one more cynical than this guy. Now, obviously, that's not going to be our donor market, but we raised $15,000 that night, and we took all of the money immediately to northern Uganda. We did our first few projects. And then we sent the photos and the GPS coordinates and the satellite images back to the 700 people and said, you did this. You came to a party, you put $20 in a box, and here's the clean water that you made happen a world away. And people were blown away by the simple feedback loop. And again, people are listening and say, this just sounds so basic. Like that's what we would expect. Tell us what you did with our money. But they had never expected to hear from a charity again, you know, throwing $20 in a box. And we said, this is going to be the differentiator. This is going to be what makes us unique. And we would hope to create a virtuous cycle of giving and generosity if we can just show people that they've made an impact. People want to help. Rachel, they want to help. They just don't trust the system. Mm-hmm. So if we could give them a system to trust, if we could show them that the sacrifice, maybe for some of those people, $20 was a lot of money. If we could show them that it actually meant something, something good would happen, not just for clean water, but maybe even for other causes.
So cool. And that was your birthday party. And then that became a part of your fundraising, right? Is that people would like, for lack of a better description, they would sort of donate their birthday to raise funds.
Yeah. And that we just stumbled into a year later. I was turning 32 and I'm like, well, I guess I should do something for my birthday again. But the club, I'm not interested in doing another party in a nightclub. That was a nice kind of turn for day one, but it doesn't scale. You know what? I'm going to get 1,000 people in a club or charge them $25 or $30. And I thought, well, I certainly don't need a party and I certainly don't need any gifts. I don't need a, you know, pair of socks or a tie or a wallet or, you know, a gift card. So what if I donated my birthday? And I thought the sticky marketing message would be that if I asked everybody I knew to donate my age in dollars, and I love that $32 was a messy number. And everybody, even if they'd come to a party, they would have spent $32 just on taxis round trip and tips for the bartenders. So everybody I knew, you know, I thought had $32 that they could give to charity, especially if they knew that 100% was going to get there. And to my surprise, after just emailing everyone I knew and this idea starts spreading and, hey, there's this guy giving up giving up his birthday and asking for $32, I raised 59 grand. So then there was a, oh, wow, okay, well, let's get other people to do this because I'm certainly not the only person on the planet with a birthday who doesn't need more crap, who could care about human beings having clean water to drink. So I started telling the story, and that September, 92 people joined me. And there was a seven-year-old kid in Austin, Texas, Max Schmidhauser, and he starts knocking on doors asking for $7 donations. Now, he lived in a nice neighborhood, I'm not going to lie, but he raises $22,000.
Oh my gosh, that's so rad.
Right? And then an 89-year-old donates her birthday, and she writes on her website, she said, I'm turning 89, and I'd like to make that possible for more people.
Oh, that's so good.
And you're like, wow, she gets it. She's lived double the life expectancy of the people in so many of these countries because of the privilege she was born into, because of the clean water system and the healthcare system that she was born into. And she didn't get to choose that any more than you and I got to choose where we were born. Or, you know, a sixth of the planet chose to be born in a place where the water was dirty. So this idea just starts to grow like crazy. And, you know, tech CEOs start donating their birthday. Will Smith, Jada Smith, they donate their birthdays. You know, it spreads through Hollywood and through Silicon Valley. And, you know, other people said, well, I can't even wait until my birthday. I got to do something else. And people start climbing mountains or walking across America in solidarity with the women walking, you know, miles every day for dirty water. And this idea, you know, winds up raising over $60 million and helping 2 million people get clean water alone.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Amazing. And you guys have, forgive me for not knowing the exact statistics here, but just in case people don't understand, this is not normal. This is not normal especially for a new charity. This is not a normal thing. And you had seen, every year you were seeing incredible growth in your fundraising. Is that right?
Yeah, we grew lights out. I mean, eight years in a row, and we were raising millions out of the gate. And you know, the 100% model, I'm not going to lie, was hard, right? As we grew, we had to go and find donors who could get excited about paying for the overhead, get excited about paying for the office. And, you know, I write about moments in the book where we almost went bankrupt and we were almost insolvent and we had all these opportunities to compromise that model or compromise our integrity. And, you know, we never wavered. And even to the point of defeat, you know, there would always be a miracle. You know, something would always happen. There was a moment where we almost shut Charity Water down because we'd raised millions for water projects, but we couldn't make payroll. And at that moment, a stranger walks in and donates $1 million to overhead.
Oh my gosh.
So there's so many stories. And to this day, you know, $330 million later, we have never touched a penny of the public's money for anything except directly funding a water project. And we've funded the overhead separately. And now it's 130 families who have come together in support of our staff, our office, our flights, you know, our insurance, the toner for the Epson coffee machine is all paid for by 130 families. And it's been entrepreneurs that people have heard of. It's been the Facebook founders and Spotify founder and you know, Twitter founder, a bunch of key executives at Apple and through Silicon Valley. And they actually get excited about helping us pay our staff pay for the team. And that's allowed 1 million people now to give in the most pure way. And so, as you said, 8 years of growth. And then we had our first down year.
And so let me talk about. Do you know what caused the first down year? Like, do you have?
Yeah, we had two huge donors take a hit in their portfolio. One company laid off 10,000 employees and the other donor stock tanked 40%.
Wow.
And they said, hey, we love you. Like, you guys didn't do anything wrong. We're just going to take a break this year. We're going to pause. So we couldn't repeat some big donations of the previous year. And this felt terrible. We went from getting 1 million human beings, 1 million new people, clean water for the first time in their life. Right? This is 50 stadiums full of people. like 50 Madison Square Gardens full of people in a single year to 800,000 the next. And I felt like we'd let 200,000 people down. And I had an existential leadership crisis. I tried to quit and hire a professional CEO and say, look, I've tapped out. I've taken this thing as far as I can, but I'm not the person to lead this anymore. We didn't grow. Worse than that, we shrank. And, you know, I write about all this in the book. There's a lot more to that. But what happened was I wound up taking a month off because I was really burned out. And I realized that so much of my identity was in the organization. And that was really unhealthy. That when Charity Water was doing well, I was doing well. And it had always done well. And then when Charity Water, when my baby started, you know, performing poorly, I was depressed. And, you know, my dad actually had a conversation with me. He said, well, okay, so you didn't grow. Like, Scott, if no one's told you this before, like, not all things go up and to the right forever, okay? Like, I've been in business 30 years. You have good years. You have bad years. You have tough years. He's like, well, did you compromise your values in any way? I'm like, no. Did you compromise your integrity? I said, no. And in fact, outside of pure donation revenue, it was the best year in the history of the organization across all these other metrics. But we helped less people. And he's like, well, okay, why don't you try again next year? And I wound up coming back to work, not quitting. And the realization was that we'd actually built the wrong business model. And I'm not talking about the 100%, but the birthdays that were fueling so much of this growth, people only donated one birthday to Charity Water.
That's interesting.
So while it worked, right, you would do, and you know, believe me, people that are listening, we still, it's a great way to get involved. It's a great way for kids to get involved. But you'll do one Rachel Hollis birthday, right? And you'll raise some money. You might build a well and you're like, cool, I did that. Now, you might take the idea and go build a school the next year for your next birthday or a health clinic, you know, 3 years from now. But you don't come back to us. So it was a non-repeatable idea. And because you tick the box, you got your well. Or your piece of a well. So we had to keep finding new people every year. And I was working as hard as I could. I was, before I started having kids, I did 98 flights in a single year and about 150 speeches. And I'm like, I can't go get any more birthdays on the road. Like, I can't work any harder. So what we realized is, well, what if we could create Netflix or Spotify for clean water? What if we could create a community that didn't just give once, but would actually show up for us month in and month out, giving what they could? So rather than the birthday, the one and done, you know, Netflix starts off every January 1 knowing it's got 100 and some million subscribers, right? And then it's growing from that base, but it's keeping people happy and it's delivering content and delivering value. So I said, well, what value could we deliver to people? How could we show them the impact of their gifts where they would sacrificially be able to give month in and month out? And I came back and built that at the end of year 9. We called it the spring. And as you could tell from the title of Thirst, I'm a big fan of double entendres. So, you know, the spring kind of meaning this place of new beginning, this time of hope and rebirth, and also the literal water that, you know, so much of the water we drink is spring water. It's water from springs. So we begin this community and we anchored around $30 a month. Which is exactly what it costs us on average across the portfolio to give one person clean water. And we just started inviting people to give 30 bucks a month, or if they could, to give 10 bucks a month. You know, we have kids turning in their allowance money to their parents who then donate it. And if they could, you know, maybe they could give 100 a month, or a small business could give a couple hundred. It was really almost less about the amount, but the act of showing up, you know, faithfully and loyally kind of fighting for extended change. And this thing just started taking off again. So in the same way that the birthdays had, it started growing. We recently added our 100th country to the spring. And it's so cool to look at a map and see people in Africa, Rachel, giving 10 bucks a month.
Wow, that's so rad.
So this, so we're coming off our down year. We built the spring. That led to 40% growth.
That is so incredible. So I want to point this out for those of you who are listening and you're inspired by the work that Scott is doing and super fired up about the idea of helping to make change like this and knowing that 100% of what you donate will go to fund clean water. Tell them where they can go to find out more. to join the spring.
Yeah. Charitywater.org/spring. So there you go. We made that one simple. Charitywater.org/spring.
I love that.
Yeah. So it's a great way to help. It really is. And you know, some people don't know this, but we actually pay back the credit card fees. So if someone was given, you know, $100 a month on their American Express, we get 97. We actually make up the difference. Those 130 wow. families pay the $3 back every month and we send the full 100 to the field.
That's so cool. Man, I loved getting the chance to hear your story today. And for everybody listening who wants to hear more, this episode comes out on the day that your book comes out.
Oh, that's cool.
Tell us about the book. Tell us about where they can get it and how you're donating the proceeds of that as well.
Yeah. So Thirst is just, it was 2 years in the writing. It's not short. I think it's 99,000 words.
Oh my gosh.
Down from 150, but it was, look, I really wanted to share my story in the hopes that it would encourage other people. You know, I believe no one is beyond redemption. It's never too late to start over, and you can use all of the dark or the mistakes or maybe even the evil in your past, in my case, and you can turn that for good. That actually can almost become your superpower. It can become a weapon for good. And, you know, it's funny, as people have pre-read the copy, pre-read the book, you know, I get a lot of, oh my gosh, you were a bad guy. I mean, oh my God, like I had no idea. You put that in there? But I wanted to be transparent. So I think, you know, hopefully you read it. And if anybody feels stuck or feels like their past defines it, I guarantee you are not as bad as me. I mean, it would be, unless you've killed somebody, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find a more degenerate lowlife than I was at the time. And, you know, now I've been blessed with this unbelievable life's mission, and I have a wife and two beautiful children, and, you know, I get to travel around the world and preach generosity and compassion and help, you know, Charity Water is now helping 4,000 new people every single day get clean water. You know, every single day of the year when I come to work, you know, we're getting another 4,000 people clean water. And it's not because of me or our staff. It's really because of our community. It's because of everyday people out there who said, hey, we could do something about this. You know, let's actually not embrace the apathy, you know, that could be so paralyzing with a global issue. But let's donate a birthday. Let's donate monthly. So I wanted the book to also be another way that people could donate. So I turned over my book advance to Charity Water and all the future proceeds. I won't make a penny from the book. I even gave the money that I got to read the book in the audio lab. I'm like, I want this to be clean. It's all got to go. So in buying the book, they are helping. And then I would hope that, look, people are going to be learning a lot more about water. Okay, we're already starting to talk about it. Droughts in California, Flint, Michigan, Cape Town. And I think some of the stories about the literal thirst facing now a tenth of the world, I think that I hope people would find them compelling. And, you know, there's so many stories of women. You know, we didn't really talk about water, but one thing I've learned now over 12 years at this, and I've traveled to 69 countries. I have been to Ethiopia 30 separate times. It is exclusively a women's issue. Mm. The men never get water. I don't care if I'm in Bangladesh or Pakistan or Sudan or, you know, South Africa, Honduras. It is culturally the job of the women and the girls to fetch the water that's not even clean. And, you know, this puts a huge burden on the women who are often the head of their house. It's one of the top reasons why girls don't get educated, why girls actually drop out of school, because they have to go walk for the water.
Wow.
And they fall behind in their studies. It's also a reason why we're not only bringing clean water to schools, but also toilets to schools. So many girls, you know, hit puberty and they stay home.
Stay home, yeah.
1 week every month. Yeah. And there's already pressure against them to be educated because they're so useful at home. So, you know, there's so many stories of both, you know, the suffering of women, but really the triumph when women get this time back. You know, that's the thing that's always surprised me is as I travel around and I'm asking women or girls, like, how's your life different? You don't have to walk for water. You know, you don't have to walk to that swamp. I would always expect them to talk about the quality change. You know, we would look at water like this, and it's water so dirty, we wouldn't let our animals drink it. Mm. We wouldn't let a hamster or a dog drink it. But yet they're actually not talking about dirty to clean as much as they're saying, let me tell you what I'm doing with 6 hours every single day.
Wow.
that I don't have to walk for water. I've got a new business. I'm selling rice at the market. I was in Zambia and Zimbabwe recently with women who were selling rugs that they were making, earning an extra income for their family. And that's just, that's an amazing. So all those stories are in the book, and I would hope that, that it would just inspire people, and it would also help people get clean water.
Man, Scott Harrison, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today. And, for inspiring all of us. The thing that I kept thinking as you were speaking was that old line that said, God doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called. And I just love, this isn't a faith-based podcast, but I just love seeing that manifest in real time. It's so inspiring to me listening, and I know to our listeners as well. So really appreciate your story and your wisdom and the awesome work that y'all are doing.
Yeah, and I should point out, Charity Water is not a religious organization.
Yeah, no.
And never has been. And I've been, you know, this was certainly birthed out of my faith experience. Yeah. And it's cool that I get to live my theology out at work. Yeah. In giving water to people who actually need it. There's actually a lot of that in the book that I like to read. But you know, I never thought that people should have to do what I do on a Sunday to either work at the organization or contribute mm-hmm. to the organization.
Totally.
And it's been amazing to see Muslims and Jews and Mormons and, you know, our biggest donor is an atheist. He thinks that I pray to a figment of my imagination.
Wow.
But he's given $18 million and he's come with me to 11 countries with his children.
That's so rad.
And that's like, it's a big tent that we're really trying to build. And we're trying to invite everybody in. Because to solve a problem this big, you need everybody,
yes.
right? Not just people who might believe the same thing that you believe.
Yeah.
But what's beautiful about both, you know, reinventing charity and about clean water is that everyone can agree to agree.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Republicans and Democrats who might fight about every possible issue,
yeah.
right? Can say, well, you know what? We don't think kids should be dying from swamp
yeah.
water. Okay. And we don't think that the kids need to believe anything special to actually have clean and safe water to drink. So it's been awesome to bring people together from different walks of life to actually unify them and say, hey, we can solve this. We could do this thing, this one thing together.
So cool. Hey, brother, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on the new book. It is called Thirst. It is out today, and everyone needs to go buy a copy right now to help support this incredible work that y'all are doing.
Thanks for having me on, Rachel.
Of course. We will be back with another episode next week. In the meantime, if you have a moment and you can write a review or subscribe to the podcast, that is life to those of us who work so hard to produce every single episode. For more information, you can check out deuspodcast.com or stalk me on every form of social media. I am Miss Rachel Hollis on every single platform. Thanks to our producer, Allison Cohen, our sound engineer, Jack Noble, and our sound editor, Andrew Weller. Most importantly, I hope you heard something today that inspires you. I'll see you next week.